begin the meeting today, let me just apologize for starting late to all of our public members. The Healthcare Access Commission meeting itself this morning was hearing of four of the working group recommendations, and our meeting ran over just a little bit, and so we apologize for starting this meeting a little bit late here. Did not anticipate the amount of questions there would be this morning. The first item on our agenda is recapturing of savings mechanisms for the healthcare system. And we did send out a list for you to look at and think about, and we also asked you if you would send us ideas that might not be on the list. And so I'd like to just start by making sure we've captured any ideas that people have that might not have been on the list. I think we have a handout for you to look through and just see if you had suggested something, if we got it on the list. Anybody have any ideas that didn't show up or that we missed? Okay. Well, then
I would just throw one more out, and that has to do with looking at where the provider tax is now.
What do you mean?
Well, whether we want to use the provider tax as a way to mechanism to recapture some savings. Well,
that was on our list that we sent out.
I don't think it made it on the list that went out.
On my list. Well, anyway, let's make sure it's on there, because obviously that's... Okay, any other ideas? If not, then let's move into the discussion of these ideas. Start by seeing if there are any questions, if everyone understands them. Yes, Ms. Roden.
Just on the re-examining the patients. Is there a little more something?
I think the idea was, the assumption behind this is we're going to insure everybody. Now, obviously, if you don't get all the way there, then you would have to take that into consideration. But the idea was that if the DSH payments, at least part of them, are being provided as an offset to help hospitals deal with uncompensated care, if we're reducing or eliminating their uncompensated care, then perhaps some of that money could be looked at. Other questions? Okay. Maybe then we could just start the discussion of people's reaction to these various ideas. I might just mention that some of them are, well, I think most of them could be done in combination with others. So they're not sort of mutually exclusive. But I do believe that we might not need all of them, or we might not want all of them. And I believe that some of them are more global in terms of their ability to capture than others. So any discussion? Dr. Roden.
The only one that on number 10, the loyalty bonus charge penalty, and the only thought I had on that was that it's not always the plan's fault that people churn in and out of the plans. I mean, there's a lot of movement between networks and who your employer is, and then what your employer does with their offering, change employer. So, I mean, maybe there's a way to do the loyalty bonus charge penalty
loyalty part of it, but I'm not sure about the penalty part of it, just because there's a lot that we don't have control over just by the nature of the marketplace.
Okay. Other discussion.
Madam Chair,
it
strikes me it may be worth talking a little bit about number one in more detail.
Okay.
And describing what exactly that one is about.
All right, I'd be happy to share what I know about it. And I would just remind you that we did have a presentation on this earlier. I mean, I realize it was months ago now, but we did have a presentation by Lynn Blewett, who has works for the university and has, as part of her job, analyzing the healthcare financing structures and the reform efforts in all the states. This is this one, just to refresh your memory, is being used by the state of Maine, and it's a savings recapture mechanism where they identify how much savings, based on what is happening, should accrue in a given year or has accrued in the previous year, I guess it is, and then they set an assessment based on that, and it does include all self-insured TPAs, all insurance mechanisms. They even have one on their list that I've never heard of, so I'll have to find out what that is sometime when I have a little more time. So it does not just sort of disadvantage one sector, as some of our insurance taxes have done in the past. And I think they have a formula where they don't take all of the savings. They take part of it, and they share part of it with the larger community. And that's about as much as I can tell you about it. If anybody else recalls anything else from that presentation that would be helpful, Mr. Benner.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I actually downloaded some stuff this morning from the Maine website trying to understand what this animal was. As Senator Berglund said, they put into statute a set of provisions that permit recapture of savings. They set up a mechanism both by which the I'm going to mispronounce this. The Dirigo board comes up with a estimate of savings that then has to go through what I guess we would call here a contested case hearing, where people come in and get to argue the point, and then a hearing officer comes up with a determination at the end as to what they think it is. At least looking at the stuff I saw, clearly lawyers making presentations to the contested case group did very well out of this business. At least in the main case, it looks like the biggest amount of savings was actually from estimates of voluntary cost restraints by hospitals and providers.
I think that's true, because they have not gotten very many people insured, right, in spite of their lofty goal to
and
do so.
And there are much smaller amounts due to offsets on charity care and bad debt.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of this, and it's the Maine culture may be different than the Minnesota culture, but the test that the hearing officer is allowed to use is that as long as the determination was reasonable, not a preponderance of evidence, not clear and convincing evidence, but that a case could be made, a hearing officer could uphold the deal. And it strikes me where there are things where you can reasonably conclude there ought to be an offset, and this kind of charity care bad debt thing may be one of them. You have a way of getting to something that would pass an administrative muster. I don't know. I get worried on this where we're asking either, you know, some state administrative body and then a hearing examiner process to come up with a number that we're only going to know at the end of the day. Being able to book that, you know, I know one of the issues here is can we get finance or the scores to count prospective savings, and at least the main model, apparently, this is an after-the-fact determination of savings, and you can obviously use it in the next cycle.
Mm-hmm.
If we're limited here to bad debt, charity care, maybe a couple other things, I think they got like $6 million out of that for the current or for their 07 determination they just made.
Right.
And that was an awful lot of work.
Well, it's because the way they've set up their Dirigo plan isn't really capturing very many uninsured people. It's a plan where there is a requirement that there be employer contribution. It's a small employer plan. And I think most states realize that that might be a piece of a solution, but it's not going to get you all the way there. And they haven't. They have not created programs like other states have in terms of SCHIP or other publicly subsidized insurance products so much. The other thing I failed to mention about this is that it has been tested in the courts and it has withstood the ERISA test. I think one of the things that this does limit you to is it limits you to savings. Of course, that might be an advantage in some people's eyes that you're not sort of quote-unquote taxing anybody more than they should have in savings. But it does rely on savings in order for you to be able to recapture the revenue for whatever investment you want to make. Other questions about this one? Yes.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Fazio.
I guess as I thought about number one and as it relates to number eight, if this was a fee that was going to be assessed on savings, the savings as they relate to public program members would be captured in number eight through negotiations year to year. You'd like to assume that cost year over year would be less and therefore negotiated increases would be less if we're successful with these various programs.
Well, except that when we get those savings in the current system, just so everybody's clear, those savings are projected as part of the forecast and they're in the general fund. They're not available to be used, quote unquote, by state government for any particular health care program necessarily.
Okay. Understood. So then that maybe takes away some of what I was going to say about the state programs. For commercial customers, then, savings that might be recouped through this, it seems to me, might unfairly be distributed based on whether or not a company were participating in and working towards better health and risk assessments and cessation or change in risk habits and things. And so I wonder whether, rather than creating another mechanism, the comment Representative Thiessen made earlier about the provider tax or other assessments that are in place, adjusting those for an equivalent amount of revenue that really were across the board, and in many ways, I think, a better kind of an assessment than some of these newer ones. That's my thought as it relates to number one. And then something Mr. Benner said made me wonder, is an offset from bad debt, as more people are covered, not something that we should have captured if we didn't already?
We haven't in the past had a mechanism to do that. We imposed the provider tax, and we did a study that showed that it was more than offset at a given point in time. Whether it still is or not is another question. But at that time, we never talked about capturing anything. We just were trying to figure out how to get something going. I guess the question I would ask you back is the feasibility of increasing the provider tax.
I guess from at least one health plan's perspective, if the provider tax increased, we would immediately increase our provider contracts by the same amount, but therefore move that fund into these sorts of programs, especially if it were an offset to other taxes in part that I believe unfairly are borne by some commercial customers and not all at this point.
Other comments? Yes,
thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree with Charlie on those comments, and I guess I would just raise the concern that we have a lot of fully insured customers in the commercial world that are implementing these programs and would like to see the return come back to their companies, that it would place an unfair burden on a small section of the employer market if, in fact, there are savings from their what they're doing, the incentive programs that they put in place, if those dollars were captured and didn't get to come back to provide premium relief for their own employees. I'm not sure how you deal with the mechanism on the back end because, as Charlie said on number 8, there are already strict formulas on any kind of government programs profits that get adjusted into those future years if, in fact, we do realize savings from the programs. And then I would just say I think on the program side, we just need to move fast toward trying to get these programs fully implemented for our state public programs members so because it's the right thing to do.
Well, I guess my comment would be that when the state recaptures the savings in Maine, I don't believe they take all of it. So that there is still an incentive for organizations to retain part of the savings and to be incented to do things that would reduce costs. I think that while the provider tax is passed through, it is in state law that it has to be. And there have been various studies at various times to try to determine if it actually is passed through. Many providers don't believe that it's passed through. And so it's been a very politically volatile thing. And so I just want to remind people of that. It affects a lot more people than an assessment on health plans would. And I realize probably none of these are going to exactly get everybody jumping up and down with glee necessarily, except that I would remind you that, you know, if we're going to invest $26.5 million in improving our public health in order to reduce smoking, obesity, and to generate public health savings, we have to have that money come from someplace. And if we do get savings out of it in the future, I mean, is it unfair to think about, I mean, not everything that's going to get you savings is going to be done by an individual company or an individual business because they don't necessarily have the public infrastructure or the critical mass to generate those kind of things in their local community. So we should keep that in mind also, I think. Are there any other comments about any of the others on here?
Would it be helpful to take a look at it through a viewpoint of, some of these we can probably estimate how much they would raise and what the scope of it would be. Some of them probably we don't have as good of information on it, but would it be worth running through them to kind of identify where we think we have some pretty good sense in what those numbers would be? Because part of what we have to do here is not just identify the mechanism, but know how much it's going to raise. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I know for some of them, for instance, like the number 4, that's about $120 million a year. that would come into the system, and that's the eliminating the deduction, you know, the exemption, I guess, on the on federal benefit, your health benefits. You don't pay income taxes on your health benefits, so it's kind of treated different than all other income that comes to you. And if you were to phase that out for the kind of at above a certain income level, that raises about $120 million a year. Health impact fee on tobacco products, what would a, you know, another 25 cents, we should have a good sense of where that would get us, I would imagine. What it, well, a 75 cents raise, what, 380, roughly in that range?
Yeah, I'm kind of remembering.
So you can, I mean, if you scale it up, that's, you know, we'd probably get
the higher you go, the less you get, but.
Right. But, I mean, we're talking probably in the range of $100 million for something like that. Let's see.
Well, you're talking about increasing it by 25 cents.
If you were to do 25 cents.
Yeah,
and
okay.
Scale up from there at some level. I mean, I think that number 2 and 3, you know, the range of that would probably be what we're paying for something less than what we're spending on uncompensated care these days. I mean, is that what those two are getting at?
I think number 2 is just getting at the idea if you have less uninsured, then maybe you could use some of the DSH money to help pay for whatever. Number 3, I think, was based on the presentation we had last week, which would indicate if you don't take into account the provider tax, that we're kind of breaking even on community benefit, and that would imply that there are some hospitals providing a lot of community benefit for their tax status and some that probably are not providing as much benefit as their tax status gives them. And so it's an idea of trying to perhaps create some sort of a community pool for that. You know, what they said to me when the original report came out is, well, it's not our fault if we don't have a lot of people that need free health care in our community. Well, it's true. It's not their fault. But we know we have a large community problem, so the idea, and simply an idea, would be to give them broader ways to provide community benefit. And another idea that's come up along these lines is, you know, perhaps allowing them to contribute to a public health program of some kind that would help improve the health status of the people in their community.
Senator Berglund?
Yes.
The only other thing I'd want to add into the discussion on the DSH payments is that I think it's important, just in terms of capturing how much money we're talking, to separate out the charity care piece from the bad debt piece, because depending upon how you structure how people are going to be covered, you may or may not be reducing bad debt.
Yes, I understand that. And you may or may not get everybody covered.
Right.
So, at least number 2 would be one that you couldn't really implement until you had done some other things to get there. So it wouldn't be a year one agenda item, definitely. Mr. Benner.
Madam Chair, I'm just trying to think through conceptually the different sort of issues that are on this page. I mean, I think there are a number of cases, and 1 and 2 are to me the most obvious, where we're saying that if we were to get to full coverage, or at least a lot closer to full coverage than we are now, certain savings should come into the system. And that savings may take the form, in this case, of reduced DSH payments. It would take the form of reduced bad debt and charity care or other things. And while getting the DSH payment money back is pretty straightforward, you know, do we want to look at ways to get bad debt and charity care money back? There's another set of issues here, which are ways of trying to improve the efficiency of the current system, the things that deal with churning, for example. We're making some assumptions here that if we keep people continuously enrolled, we ought to be getting better health outcomes faster than we'll be creating additional expenditures in any event for those people, and that ought to generate some savings. Then finally, there are a set of issues around trying to find funding sources to deal with both the expansion of coverage issues and or the affordability issues, which might be other than just taking, other than trying to fight for whatever share we get of a general fund appropriation in a given session. And I guess I ask this both you, Senator Berglund, and Representative Thiessen. Now, are you asking us to say which of these three general strategies do we want to proceed on, or you're seeking our support in proceeding on these strategies and then specific responses to which of the sub-items we think make sense to proceed on and which of them we think either doesn't generate enough money to make it worthwhile or... as Charlie was talking earlier, there may be a different way to get to that same amount of money, which we simply think is easier to do. I guess I'm seeking some direction on what you want us to do here.
I think you're right. We just added things here that people had sent in to us, and they're not necessarily what we were trying to focus on. So I think ideas here that might have cost savings, we would just pass them on to the Healthcare Access Commission. There are other working groups that have been working on ideas. We'll just add these ideas to the pot that they're presenting. But I think the real purpose of this working group was to figure out how to restructure the way we finance things in order to get funding to pay for expanding care to the uninsured, for investing more in primary care physicians, training for public health programs to reduce obesity and smoking. The list goes on and on of reinvestments that are being discussed or are being suggested. At least some people have suggested that it might be more successful if we're not just adding money, but we actually are generating savings and reinvesting some of those savings. Some of them would be in the direction of reinvestment. Others would just be ways of raising revenue, which might be necessary at the beginning, I don't know, in order to generate, some of the funding that would be needed to start with in order to get some of these things going. For example, if you want to talk about medical home, maybe there are some parts of the state where you can't actually even do it to get the savings if you don't have enough primary care physicians for the population in that area of the state. And so if you need to, it's just an example of where you might need to invest something at least to get the infrastructure that would be needed to carry out the idea. And we talked about that a little bit when we had the presentation from the community clinics about not necessarily having enough primary care providers in all parts of the state. So, there might be some investment that's needed in the beginning that you don't have savings yet, maybe for a limited period of time, and then there might be savings that are generated that could sustain that investment in the future. And I think that's kind of the area that we were thinking about talking about in terms of making recommendations to the full Healthcare Access Commission. Dr. Williams?
I guess I just need a clarifying question on two of these. And it just, in terms of 15, so fully dedicate the Healthcare Access Fund to healthcare, and number six, recognizing the savings. I've sort of been around enough to realize that that's like the you know, running joke, but I mean, are there mechanisms to actually make those two things happen? I mean, is there something the legislature can actually do that then, or is that just one of those things that we really, that's my question, I guess.
Well, in terms of number 15, it is statutorily dedicated. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we can't recommend much more than that in terms of what the legislature could do. I mean, you could propose a constitutional amendment, constitutionally dedicated, I suppose, if you think it's worth that effort. There is a piece of legislation floating around in the legislature to create a little commission to make recommendations to the legislature about what appropriate expenditures out of that fund might be. We've done pretty well recently in not spending it on things that I think most people would consider inappropriate. It hasn't been used in the general fund since 2003, really.
Right, since we've had surpluses, right?
And that was one time. It was not an ongoing drain on the healthcare access fund. That was a pretty hard-fought battle, and it wasn't a very visible battle, but we kept from having a permanent drain on the healthcare access fund that year.
And the forecasting part?
I guess I'd ask Representative Thiessen to talk about that when he's put that on the list, and I don't know how you do that either. I've been trying to figure out how to do that for about 25 years now. So somebody can help me figure it out. I sure would. Well, maybe somebody's got an idea I haven't thought of, you know? I mean, it's always possible.
Well, I think this comes to I think this actually raises a larger issue, too, and it has to do, I think, in the end, with how sophisticated we can be in our modeling about what trend would be if we don't do anything versus capturing what actually comes out. So, I mean, the idea here would be to establish a kind of a prospective trend line of what we expect going into the future if we keep with the status quo. And then to the extent that expenditures within that kind of that piece of spending, that spending stream come in below that, some could go to the general fund and some would go to the healthcare access fund, for instance, or would at least stay within the healthcare budgets. And I think really the challenge there is knowing whether we have the capacity to model kind of status quo trend in our public program spending. And I mean, honestly, if we could do that, we could maybe also do that outside of our public programs, and that would give us a way to really measure whether we're saving things and how we can recapture some of those items. And I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on whether that's even a possibility. I mean, we've had a few discussions with people that suggest that maybe it is, but maybe people that are more engaged in the business have some thoughts about that. I'm looking at that end of the table for no.
I would say there are mechanisms for attempting to predict what the financial impact would be of changes in behavior, changes in compliance with various programs, changes in pursuit of a variety of risk factors. I will also be quick to tell you that the financial people who help you predict those want to be as conservative as they possibly can be, especially as they relate to predicting future premiums and things like that. So I think it is possible. I think there's a growing body of evidence to help with the accuracy of those predictions, and at the same time, we're always very conservative with them.
And just to kind of follow, I had an amendment, I think, in Representative Huntley's committee last year that we put out there that in very simple paragraph would have attempted to do this, not knowing whether we could model it or not. And basically, the amendment did what I just said. Now, finance may flip over some of that kind of things and push back pretty hard on that. But I think that's actually one thing we should include in our recommendations going forward and continue to work on it, because I think there's a chance that we could actually put something in place that would do that, and we might as well give it another run.
Yes. I had a question about number 12. And if we're talking about, you know, obviously penalizing employers, is this something kind of like your small employer buy-in for Minnesota Care? And
no, this is an idea that exactly is being done in Vermont and Massachusetts, where in Massachusetts they require everyone to have insurance. Mm-hmm. And then if an employer doesn't provide a certain level of benefit, it's a pretty low level of benefit. I think, in fact, all it is that they have to at least be offering 125 benefits.
Okay.
Then if they aren't doing something like that, then there's a penalty that's assessed on them that goes into the general fund. It's not very much money. I think we heard Arissa's presentation earlier in the year. In one of the states, it's $365 a year, and in one of the states, it's $278 or something like that a year. So it's not, I mean, you know, I think one of the questions that's been asked is whether it might actually encourage employers to not provide coverage if they could just get by with doing that. But the other side of the coin is that, you know, if you're requiring individual responsibility but you don't require any employer responsibility, is that fair? I think that's the argument that they had. And I don't know. It has not been tested in the courts as far as ERISA is concerned, but most of the folks that hang around ERISA issues believe it's such a small amount that it's not probably going to fail the ERISA test.
And just, if I could, Madam Chair, just to come back to Pete's question, I mean, I think ultimately what we're looking for, we need to make a set of recommendations to the Healthcare Access Commission. And so my sense is maybe we divide it up into different categories, but that we kind of go through these. And, I mean, maybe one way to do this is to say if anybody has an objection that they don't want one of these to be on a list, is maybe one way to cut at it, and we can have a discussion around that. And a second would be then to prioritize some of these proposals as things that we think would be the first thing to look at as we work through the list. So that may, I don't know if that mm-hmm. helps to move the discussion. Does that make sense? Are there any that people are kind of outright would refuse to, like, vote yes on?
Madam Chair, I've been trying to figure this out in my head. You know, as the potential largest benefactor of having a larger insured population at HCMC, but also the largest recipient of DSH payments at HCMC, it's a very difficult analysis. Let me give you the provider perspective of our medical assistance payments, which relates to DSH. Our medical assistance payments were currently being paid what I think approximately 2002 cost minus approximately 11% for the ratable reduction, and on top of that we're paying a 2% Medicare tax. So when I think of disproportionate share payments, is that for our uninsured population? Or is that for that 50% of our population that's on state programs that I am being paid at very low rates? The answer is I don't know. I understand. I can trace the legislative history for DSH. I understand that. But this doesn't feel like a sum-zero game for HCMC. It feels like that given the very large uninsured population which we have, which many of them may not be eligible for state programs. It doesn't feel like it's a sum-zero game.
Representative Huntley?
Apart from HCMC, we would have to have a waiver. I mean, if we insured everybody, then you lose a lot of the dish money.
There is a formula for allocating dish funds that is not necessarily dependent on your uninsured. And we have gotten permission in the past to use dish money to pay for GAMC. So I think we shouldn't worry about whatever legal issues there are. I think we should worry about what we think is the right thing to do and whether we agree with something or whether we think it's a problem.
Madam Chair.
I think what the concern is being expressed here is that because there have been reductions made in public program payments to hospitals, that they view the dish payments as just making up somewhat for those cuts rather than compensating them for the uninsured. Mm-hmm. Although I think it probably is used to do that also.
Yes.
So there's probably some of each that goes on in there. And so I guess it would be fair then maybe to make a note here that in addition to whatever uninsured would remain, we also would need to be cognizant of whatever we're doing with dish money to offset Medicaid payments. Other questions or Dr. Fazio?
Madam Chair, thank you. At the risk of being, I'm not sure if it's annoying or more annoying, I'd like to come back to the provider tax, if I may. If part of our mission is to expand those who are covered, it seems to me some of that could be continuing coverage for people who have it now so that the pool we're working on doesn't get any bigger. And part of that for me feels like keeping employers in the game. A lot of those employers right now are disadvantaged with how we spread some of our taxes and mm-hmm. assessments on them. Mm-hmm. So when I think about the provider tax relative to other taxes and assessments that relate to healthcare costs, who it assesses and the way it is inflated feels like it ties most accurately to healthcare costs. I come back to your comment about the emotion. I understand the emotion that goes along with the healthcare tax, but I'm also reasonably sure I understand the facts that go along with the provider tax. So please don't take this as flip, but I guess I wonder if we shouldn't, on a Friday night, stop the provider tax. I guarantee you we will deflate our payments to providers by the exact percentage that day because we put it along when we created the provider tax. And then on Monday, let's reinstitute it at a higher rate, and we'll increase our payments to providers again. And we'll just lose the revenue from that weekend, but we'll have established a new fact base for this. Short of my flip potential solution, I really would like us not to ignore that possibility to help some of the insured in Minnesota stay insured.
Dr. Fazio, I agree with you. I'm not one of those people that hates the provider tax, but I certainly do hear from a lot of the ones who do, so I don't think we can just ignore it. And it does have a redistributive effect in terms of the way we've structured some of our public health care programs, especially Minnesota Care, which is the program that it pays for. So that, we really emphasize primary care in the program, and a lot of the revenue comes from specialty care. So it does have that impact. So I don't hate the provider tax, and I do believe that you pass it through. Can I just ask a question? When we temporarily reduced it by 0.5%, did you take it back during that period of time?
I would want to check to be 100% sure of the accuracy of that answer before I made it.
their comments?
I think the answer's no.
You think the answer's no?
Yeah.
Oh. How do you know?
We didn't, that's apparently. We didn't.
No? Okay. Yeah, because if you didn't, then, you know, who's to say that, you know, when we did that, I was so, it just upset me so much that I just felt like we were going up to the gold horses and throwing bushel baskets of money out into the wind. And who was going to have this money was very unclear to me. And, you know, I'm kind of conservative that way. I like to know when I'm spending money, what I'm getting, and who's getting the money. And that was one of those deals where it was just so unclear to me who was going to have all this money. But it's over with now, so I'm over it. But yes.
Madam Chair, a number of these items here appear to be at least things that I would consider part of a benefit set. And is there somebody reporting back to the commission on the benefit set that we're going to use to determine affordability? And one of the reasons I think that it's important that it gets addressed is this is kind of like Tom Huntley's, we're talking about 7% of the problem but ignoring the 93. And I think, as we've heard some allusion to, there's a lot of the population out there as individuals and companies who are also unable to afford health care. So if all we do is figure out ways in which we can remove the money around the coffers of the state government to expand the coverage and don't do anything about the businesses or the actual affordability of health care, I think we've probably failed to do our duty. And my personal belief happens to be that one of the key mechanisms for controlling the cost of health care is coming to some societal agreement on that benefit set, how it's controlled, how it's expanded, and how you fairly judge when you move technology along and all those related issues. So that if nobody's looking at that or nobody's asking anybody to look at that, I think we're missing a huge opportunity to really address something that expands out to the full 100% here.
We do have one of the working groups did recommend an evidence-based benefit set and reinforcing it by having larger co-payments for procedures that have less evidence to support them and smaller or no co-pays for procedures that show great improvement in an individual's health, especially if they have a chronic disease. There was also some information that was presented as a part of that today of the technology assessment mechanism that's being used in Washington State, which is an evidence-based process for determining whether or not a certain procedure should be covered or not covered, or if they should be covered only at certain provider locations and not paid for in general.
Well, I think the way, at least the way that I've viewed it in my head, which is limited to these issues, but is that if you come up with an agreed essential benefit set that works and meets the needs for everybody, at least at a minimum, and then you mandate that that is the benefit set that is offered by everybody at a minimum, then you at least give the options out there to the individuals who aren't being covered by state programs and the businesses that work with this to lower their costs and then let those with more means decide what other benefits are going to add to it. I think if we don't get down to addressing those issues in a fair way, I don't know that we'll ever get to the concerns that we have affordable health care out there in this group who's bordering on 300% of the federal poverty guidelines or wherever we decide that affordability really happens.
And that there were other recommendations in that from that group about evidence-based decision-making centered at the patient level to try to get at some of that. But part of the difficulty is that there really there are not a lot of benefits that you can just outright say nobody needs. We have the Oregon list, and you know, in their Medicaid program, they save 10% by not paying for any of those. But when we put that forward in Minnesota, Department of Human Services came back and said, "Oh no, no, you know, for this thing and that thing, it's not very many people, but there's some people that really need this, so we can't just say we won't pay for it at all." That working group did come back and suggest for some of those that we reduce our payment. We not just eliminate paying altogether, but we reduce our payment for some of those because it'd be another way of getting at the problem of more than just the few who need it using it.
Well, clearly they're difficult issues. I think we've already begun in the system to itemize some things that people don't need but want, and they fall outside the insurance mechanisms. Sometimes, surprisingly, they fall inside insurance mechanisms, and you scratch your head and say, you know, how can you pay somebody $2,000 to take this mole off their head and $800 for something that saved their life, kept them from bleeding to death? But that's the way the system works, and we can change those things. I just don't think it is as hard as it's been characterized to make some basic decisions on benefit sets and the speed with which we're willing to pay for advanced technology. I don't think it would set off the beginning of the next dark ages in healthcare. I think it would set off a rational discussion about what we can afford and when. And I think that affording also means that we would at least offer those same things to everybody. Right now, what we do say is, we don't have you in, so it isn't that you're not covered. It's just that we're not going to pay for you. And they don't show up. They don't come for them. Or when they do, they come when it's a disaster. So it's a different way of saying we're not going to do that, and one that I think a lot of us feel is not a very fair or rational way to say no.
Well, I certainly think we should have more discussion about that. I don't think this list was intended to incorporate that, but I think it's a different topic. Yeah. But I do think
I just see some of the elements there, like numbers 12, I think, limiting networks. You know, those start to get at construction of a benefit set and things like
right.
that.
Right. So. I think some of these are, as I said earlier, simply ideas that people think might save money. And I think maybe when we asked people to give us more ideas, they were a little confused about what we were asking for. So maybe we should just go down the list and identify those, and we'll just pass those on to the commission and ask people to look into it some more. And then we can reduce our list, and we can focus on those items that are reinvestment strategies. And so let's just go down the list. I think I think number 9 would be one of those cost-saving mechanisms, trying to get patient assessments filled out. I think the loyalty bonus idea would be one of those. Continuous 12-month eligibility, I guarantee you, is not a reinvestment strategy. It might save some money, but it's got a price tag on it. We did do some of that this session also. I think number 13 would be a cost containment recommendation. Number 14 would be a cost containment strategy.
Madam Chair?
And number 16 would be. And we've added to the bottom of the list provider tax. Okay. Yeah. Mr. Benner.
Yeah. Madam Chair, on item 14, as being a member of the ICSI board, I've got to watch the discussion on high-tech diagnostic imaging, not fully in detail, but in enough detail. It's both, I think, a very encouraging discussion, which is health plans and providers were able to really engage in a discussion on what was evidence-based quality imaging and figure out how to both embed the clinical guidelines in electronic medical records electronic systems where those exist, and at least try to come up with a consistent set of pre-authorization criteria in effect for where that doesn't. I would defer to the physicians and the plan members here, but my sense is there are lots of other cases or instances out there where there is a lot of work that could be done and where I think there is commitment both by plans and provider organizations to do it, but it kind of takes a push. And in the imaging case, things got to a critical mass, and I think, frankly, the plans felt they just had to finally do something. But when it became clear something was going to happen, it became a very good, positive, collaborative process with a very good outcome. And as we look at things like 14, I think it would be worth discussion or more detailed discussion as to what the state, either as a regulator or a purchaser, can do to help plans and provider organizations figure out a way to tee stuff up so that we don't wait for the next overload situation, which finally makes something intolerable to do it, but that people can, the practitioners know where these places are. But we help them engage with each other on this so that, there's an ongoing process here of this taking place. It's a lot easier for everyone to deal with, diabetes or depression or chronic care issues where there's an agreement on underuse. Because at the end of the day, this is going to mean probably increased compensation for provider organizations and better in some cases near-term savings for the plans, and in any case medium and long-term savings for the plans. This gets a lot harder when you're dealing with something where it's going to be controversial because there are at least near-term revenue losses for someone in a deal. And I think we're unrealistic to just hope the plan provider community can do this without us helping them engage in the process.
Okay, is there any objection then if we just pass on and we can make this number 14 to be more generic in terms of not just referencing imaging, yes, in terms of other supply-sensitive care? And we'll pass that on to the full access commission. And then so we would be referring 9, 10, 11, 13, 14, and 16 on. Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. When I look at 9 and 16, I think of those things, and even 10 somewhat related, but in terms of looking at where's the appropriate place to put an incentive on care management or health assessment, we may find there's a good way to do it, and it may not even be in the healthcare setting, but I think that's worth some work to figure out how we would best operationalize getting someone to take the assessment and then getting them to engage in programs around care management, which is difficult and more complex for people on state public programs. Number 9 is a worry that we would not want to create more uncompensated care than we have today. And number 10, I think the loyalty bonus churning penalty, I think what we find with state public programs members is that they lose their Medicaid status for a lot of reasons that really don't have anything to do with the customer service part, and we would definitely have to plug up all of those holes.
Right, and we do have an item on our agenda today to at least generate some discussion about that in terms of...
But it's the paperwork, it's the change in status, it's all those other reasons why people may, mm-hmm. including we also give people a choice every year to change plans, which is good, but there's lots of reasons why people would change plans that really don't have much to do with customer service. But if you were going to put plans at risk for government programs to pay for a premature delivery because the person hadn't, you know, had showed up for a prenatal appointment, I mean, that's very significant. And we need to look at how we would best keep people engaged, get them into the medical home, and put some emphasis on that part of the program, I think, before we'd want to do huge penalties.
Yeah, we did have a recommendation from one of our working groups that we encourage and send people to be involved in receiving their care through a medical home. I think our discussion today indicated that we do not believe that that's been fleshed out enough in terms of what do we mean by incentive,
right.
And that different, I mean, our Medicaid program obviously can't have the same kind of incentives that maybe our state health plan could have for state employees. And so we need to acknowledge that, and there does need to be some more work done on that, and I would ask if you have ideas about that, feel free to forward them to us, because I'm not sure how much more that working group is going to get that stuff fleshed out.
And just to that point, I mean, I'm reading 9 and 10. I'm not sure we have to limit that necessarily is limited to public programs. You know, you could, the test of churning, you know, you'd pay for it through your public program, but the test of churning, for instance, or loyalty, wouldn't necessarily have to be just the people in a public program. You know, it could be what is your loyalty rate overall. And, you know, so I just to kind of throw that out and to come back to the issue that it was raised before about the provider tax and dealing with the 7 versus the 93%. I don't think that that's quite exactly a fair characterization, because a lot of what we're going to be doing here is actually making healthcare more affordable for those people in the 93%. And I'm convinced that's going to take some public dollars to do. So it's not just about covering and it's not 7 and 93 anymore. It's 9 and 91, maybe. So we may have to change the talking point, Tom.
just so it's clear, the reference had absolutely nothing to do with the provider tax.
So, okay, right. So
well,
the
public program.
And I think, you know, like in our fully insured market, should there be, should an assessment be part of the required benefit set, and should there be some incentives for people to participate? Should there be some incentives for people to participate in terms of being involved in programs that would help change their behavior if they are at risk of a chronic disease or have a chronic disease? You know, I think some of these things go beyond public programs and probably should go beyond public programs. So just want to mention that, so we're not just thinking public programs here. But at any rate, anybody have anything else to add to these items that we might pass along, that we would pass along to the Access Commission in terms of cost-saving ideas? Okay, then we will take those off our list for further discussion today, and we will incorporate them into recommendations that we'll pass on to the Commission. Now, the other ones that are left, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 15, and what I would call 17 provider tax, we still need to discuss and say yes, no, or give some priority to.
I guess I would raise one other issue here, and it kind of comes to the provider tax and moving towards broader-based discussion. I don't know if we want to go beyond kind of the healthcare arena, although I suppose the cigarette tax is kind of does that. You know, but part of the discussion here is some of these fees are on a small group of people. Provider tax maybe covers everybody, but has some cost shifting. I mean, do we want to also put on the table more broad-based taxes, you know, like an income tax or anything? Or is that kind of beyond the scope of the group?
Well, I guess I think that what I would hope we're trying to do here is to aim for possible success.
Okay.
I'm assuming we haven't all been getting together just because we want to admire each other or whatever. I mean, and I think, you know, realistically, I just don't think, you know, broader based tax. I think, you know, we've got the health impact fee here because obviously it has some direct correlation with improving and even perhaps funding public health efforts. But most of what we're talking about here has to do with health care in one way or another, or assessments or some kind of a mechanism that's tied to health care. And I think part of that was because we were thinking about reinvestment when we were giving this group its charge.
Fair enough.
Yes.
I wanted to address number three, mm-hmm. and I think this is similar to a bill that's been proposed at the national level that requires hospitals, and someone might know more about this than I do, that requires hospitals to provide a certain percentage of charity care in terms of uninsured patients. And I would just want to make sure that when we're looking at community benefit standards, that didn't just include uninsured care, because there are certain hospitals that have, you know, like Gillette Children's Hospital, for example, that has a large percentage of patients that are covered under MA because of their disability, so they don't have a lot of uninsured patients, but they're still providing a community benefit. So I'd want to just make sure that that's broad.
Yeah. When we had the report last time about community benefit, it was a broader definition than that. It included, you know, providing funding for community public health programs. It was a fairly broad list. Maybe it could be broadened some more. I don't know, but
okay. Make sure.
Mr. Benner.
Madam Chair, I don't disagree with your comment that we are not here to admire each other or the problem, and we are trying to find a set of proposals that can actually be acted on in the 2008 session and passed. And I'm fully committed to doing that. I mean, having said that, I mean, if you know, if we now are at 9% uninsured, at least, you know, according to United Healthcare's latest numbers, that's where we're at. And if we come up with, and if we're able to establish a definition of affordability, we are going to find some percentage of the population which is teetering on the brink, as well as some fair number of employers teetering on the brink, which makes that number bigger. We are looking at real money on this.
Even just the people that are eligible today and not
right.
enrolled,
that's
we're
right.
talking
if we just
real
fully
money.
Enrolled, right, if we just fully enrolled in MA and Minnesota Care, we're looking at real money. I think it's important that as we are, and this may be another group's job, but I think it is important that as we, you know, come up with our statement as to what full coverage means, and we come up with a statement of what affordability means, that we, you know, that we price that for real. I mean, because that's where we're trying to get to. Mm-hmm. Now there's different ways of getting the money. Can we, in fact, get money out of the system? And that those are some of those are issues like number one and number two. Some of those are issues like changes in care delivery and provision of services where we will in fact find, you know, hopefully find savings by doing good chronic care. You know, bookable money helps us get there, assuming we get to keep it and it doesn't go to build prisons. But some of it at the end of the day is going to be we need money. And, you know, to me, it is one thing to have a discussion about, you know, places to try to find money for in the 2008 session for the rest of this biennium, maybe going into the next biennium, which may be a more limited set of places we can look at. But my guess is when we look at the total target we're trying to get at, there's no conceivable way we raise the tobacco tax enough. I supported the provider tax back in the 90s, and
we are lucky to have it.
Mm-hmm. Guess is the provider tax can't sustain the number of zeros we have to get to, depending on what some of the other things come up with. While perhaps we need to look at things where we can come up with, you know, $10 million here, $20 million someplace else as a near-term way of getting through 08, strategies where the best you do is a couple million here, a couple million there, you know, at the end of the day doesn't get to the real thing. So I'm not averse to near-term, to coming up with near and mid-term, both revenue raising and savings issues, but I think that's got to be in the context of a broader commitment. I mean, you've talked publicly about these are all, you know, stitches on the needle here, and the pieces got to come together. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I'm realistic enough to know that we're not going to get to 100% coverage and 100% affordability in 2009, but I think it's incumbent on I think we need to say whether that target date is 11 or 13 or 15, whatever that is.
In the statute right now, it's set for 11.
That we be saying, and this is what you got to do to get there. The governor and the legislators in your wisdom will figure out how close we get. But I have a real problem saying we say we can, you know, this is what we're going to do, and by the way, folks, that's all we need to do now. Because, I mean, our history on this is we did big efforts in the early 90s, and then, you know, it was whittle away at it for the next 10, 12 years. So my sense is what we do in 08 and 09, you know, as part of this push, this is going to have to sustain us for a fairly long period of time. So we better push this thing as hard as we can, because folks aren't going to want to wade back into this thing again until 2017 or 2018, or hopefully I have common sense to say no the next time.
Well, and I might just say, although this may relate somewhat to our next discussion as well, you know, the forecasting trends that we're seeing with Minnesota Care are that we're losing on the enrollment side about 1,000 people a month over what we traditionally have had. On the re-enrollment side, we're doing pretty good. We're not maybe as bad off as we are with some of our Medicaid programs on the re-enrollment stuff, but on the enrollment stuff, we are losing ground. And I don't know exactly why that is, but it is something to keep in mind. Any other discussion of these items? I think we should maybe go back to the suggestion that Representative Thiessen made. Are there items on here that people think they would not want to see on a list that was recommended to the Full Access Commission? We have made note of concerns about dish payments. Are there others on the list that people have concerns about?
Madam Chair, just as a note, of the algebra for the provider tax, so not commenting on provider tax, but the algebra for the provider tax. We also pay provider tax on the state programs now.
Mm-hmm.
And so the algebra would be, that would also be a net loss for all providers.
Well, we do pass it on in our rates. We used it during the 2003 session to avoid worse things, but we did it to generate federal share.
I understand.
And we offset it then by the loss that you take on your state share. I don't know how much further we can go with that because, you know, as you know, we have to have the federal laws require provider taxes to be broad-based. And at that time, we didn't include it, so we could include it up to what we were taxing. But now, if we're going to do more, we would have to increase the whole thing, or at least the whole thing for some groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that we passed it through. I'll show you in the budget sheet if you don't think so. Other concerns? Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. I remain concerned about number one in isolation of other considerations, just based on who would be impacted and the burden of current fees and assessments being borne by certain parts of our economic population.
And can you just explain that a little more to me in terms of what you mean by certain populations? If it's broad-based and everybody's, you know, what, I mean, let's just say you decide you saved $100 million. And let's just say you decided you were going to try to recapture 10% of that. So you're going to recapture $10 million. Whatever your assessment mechanism is, it has to be equal across the board. So when you talk about what you're saving it collectively as a society or as a state or as a healthcare delivery system. When you assess it, you're assessing it equally. You're not assessing one organization a greater amount than another organization. And you're not assessing, I mean, you're not going to pay it if you're a small employer buying insurance from somebody as opposed to a self-insured organization that's using just the administrative services. So I'm having trouble. Help me.
Well, my concern would be even if your assumptions are true, that if it would be whatever this assessment were, it would be spread equally among the intended population. It is spread equally over and above a system that currently is unequally distributed. And so the total burden on, for instance, fully insured remains greater in relative weight than it is for other kinds of insured accounts. And so I just worry about
You're talking about MSHA assessment, things like that.
So unless
would you like to include in here some recommendation that be, we look at ways, if there are, to alleviate that burden?
Yes, please. And I apologize that earlier I wasn't clear that as I talked about the provider tax, it was as much about equilibrating the current burden as it was funding new programs. It was even more emphasized in that regard. So looking at our total assessment and tax base as it relates to health care and attempting to equalize that. And if that were done and one were done with the same equality, then I have less concern.
So if there were a way to incorporate revenues to remove the MSHA assessment, even though we would be recapturing money through the system in other ways, that would be something you think we should do. Is there agreement on that? I mean, I know it's being discussed in other venues too, what to do about the MSHA assessment, so. Yes.
I just have a question mainly of Dr. Fazio. I don't know very much about the provider tax, but Can you please explain how it's unequally administered now?
Madam Chair, my comment was more that the provider tax is equally distributed. It is paid for anybody who seeks health care services. The MSHA assessment, I believe, is divided over fully insured accounts as an add-on to their premiums, as are obviously premium taxes. So self-insured employers, for example, don't contribute to those two funds, whereas they do contribute to the provider tax. So the provider tax is indexed against, is assessed against all people who use services and increases with medical inflation.
So would it be fair to say that in general you're asking to take a deeper look at the taxation mechanisms that are healthcare specific, whether they deal with health insurance or providers or wherever they are? And if that's what you're saying, I'd add an, I mean, there's a collection of items you could put under that rubric, including, I don't remember the number, but it's the one about retaining nonprofit status for community care. Well, it seems like the retention of nonprofit status or having a nonprofit status is an all or nothing proposition with respect to tax liability. I mean, if you're a nonprofit, you don't pay any taxes on certain things. If you're going to take a good hard look on the entire taxation structure involved in healthcare, why not also include in that look some sort of gradation, say, of tax liability that depends upon service to the community or lack thereof? Does that make sense?
I don't think we could do it. I mean, you know, it's all or nothing because that's the way the tax system is, and I don't know that we're going to have. I mean, we can talk about replacing some taxes with other taxes. I think that's.
Well, in a way.
But, you know, to say, well, you're, you know, you're going to pay half of your property taxes because you're sort of half not-for-profit and half for-profit. I mean, you know, there's just no administrative way to do that.
Okay, but there are other mechanisms that are already on the table, like the disproportionate share payments and the provider taxes and so forth and so on. And I guess what I'm suggesting is that if you have those sorts of existing mechanisms that aren't bound by those same requirements, the same administrative requirements, and if you're going to take a good hard look at them anyway, is there some way to incorporate into whatever recommendations you might make that part of the assessment has to do with service to the community or lack thereof?
Well, you could, but you would have to have a way to measure that.
Right.
And you'd have to have a way of accounting for it equally across the system. And right now, the only reason we have something on here about community benefit for our hospitals is because we do have a measurement technique that's been used by the Catholic hospitals.
And which is? What is that measurement technique?
It's a mechanism that has become standardized because most hospitals use it. And we had a report at our last meeting about what that community benefit is under that standard as opposed to the tax benefit of not-for-profit hospitals. In terms of measuring the whole system, I don't think there is anything to measure community benefit.
Well, would a very simple one simply be the percentage of would depend on it would you'd have to be careful how you measured it, but you could say, you know, you'd have to be careful about how you define your denominator. But let's say your denominator is number of patients or number of services delivered or dollar amount of services delivered or whatever it is. And the numerator is the percentage of those that are delivered to low-income people or delivered to people that can't pay, or it's a bad debt thing, or it's an uninsured, you know, uncompensated care, something like that.
Well, that is part of what is used in the measurement for hospitals. Now, when you get to the clinic level, we have a lot of for-profit clinics in Minnesota. We have some not-for-profit, but we have a lot of for-profit. And we certainly, when you get to the high-tech area, most of it's for-profit. I mean, I think all of it is. I don't know if any of it's not. So, you know...
And
I don't think the idea is that we want to get more people to be for profit. I think the idea is if you're trying to create a community benefit, maybe there are ways to try to even it out a little bit more rather than having some doing a whole lot and some doing not so much, you know. I don't know that we're going to have time to reinvent the tax system here, is what I'm trying to say to you.
I can appreciate that.
I don't know. Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair, just back on Charlie's point on number one, I think the concern there is if MSHA's in place, the premium tax is in place, it's one more tax on that fully insured market, mm-hmm. and just to note that that's the shrinking market in
mm-hmm.
Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Well, number one would not be just on the fully insured market. It would be on all, everything. But we have made a note here that, and I take it from the lack of controversy or the lack of opposition that recommending that the MSHA and premium MSHA assessment and premium taxes be phased out as a part of any restructuring effort, if possible, would be done. So we have that on the list as a recommendation. Does that alleviate enough of the concern that number one could stay on the list to people, or are there more concerns than that? I'll take it to mean that that's taking care of that concern. Any others that people feel especially strongly that should not be on a list of recommendations?
And Madam Chair, just to clarify, maybe when we're saying recommendations, are we saying the Healthcare Access Commission should adopt these things, or are these options? Maybe that.
Well, at this point, I think we're saying that they would be options that should be considered.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, we're at somewhat of a disadvantage here, I would say, because originally when I thought about the work of this group, I thought that by now we would have a lot more fiscal information than we have. And it's become clear to me that that information is going to come pretty late in the year. You know, some of it may be in November, but, you know, because the department is working on the forecast, and they have been until a week ago, they haven't started any of the requests on anything up till now, much less things that might come in, after today. So I'm thinking, you know, it'll be late November and December when we get this back, which is getting kind of late for us to be making recommendations to the full Healthcare Access Commission. We don't even have, for example, we asked for two things when we were having the affordability discussion. We were asking for adjustments to the upper limit of what the premium structure would be for our public programs, and we asked for it with, you know, the assumptions of today's enrollment, and then we ask for it if we mandated responsibility for having coverage. We haven't got any of that back. So we don't have anything back about how much we might generate in savings, and we don't have anything back in terms of how much we might need in terms of revenue for just one thing, not to mention the other things that might require investment. So we are at a disadvantage here, and I kind of feel like it might be kind of hard to zero in on one or two things here, but certainly if people wanted to prioritize them, I think that would be appropriate if there can be enough agreement on them to prioritize them. Yes.
I mean, what you just said, I completely agree with, in the fact that, I mean, if we don't know how much any of this is actually going to give us back in savings, you know, I mean, for number three, the thought of not having not-for-profit hospitals in Minnesota is just something I would never want to look at personally. I think that's a scary concept for us to have on here. Now, if it was something like $1 billion a year in savings, that might be something else, but... I think that we are at a very large disadvantage at this point because we don't know what we're going to be able to get from this stuff.
Yeah, and I think we want to make clear that what we're not saying is that people would necessarily lose their not-for-profit status. They would just be paying into a pool to retain that. So I don't think the concept here is that we're going to go to for-profit, move in direction of for-profit hospitals.
So is there some interest in prioritizing these, or is there enough confusion that we don't think we can even do that?
Without the numbers, it's hard.
Without the numbers, it's hard. Okay. All right. Well, any other comments then before we move on? Okay. The next item, affordability discussion. Again, as I said, we don't have numbers. I really hoped we would have them by today, but we don't. So we next week need to make some kind of a report back to the full Healthcare Access Commission, and so Paul has done some work and has some handouts for us.
Yeah, I think, did people get the charts? Uh-huh. Yeah. And did you get there's a tax piece here, too?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is just to kind of put what we're talking about in a little bit of perspective for in terms of real, you know, real people's lives, in the sense that a model could really be a real person's life, I suppose. But this is based on the Jobs Now data. I think there was a presentation at one point that I missed, but this is coming from their information. And... a couple things to think about as we go forward. I mean, I think the 100% of federal poverty guidelines section is there for context. It's really kind of irrelevant to our discussion because those folks don't pay anything for, you know, they're on Medicaid now, and that's probably not going to change. So I think really where we're more talking about is at the higher levels. And so while this chart works, basically it takes four examples of family types and shows, you know, you spend how much they'd spend on a variety of things, what their income would be at those different levels of federal poverty, and then what would be left over for health care and everything else. The piece that's not in there, that why we have the tax chart, is that there's no taxes aren't taken out of here, and it's hard to do because it varies, hard to put in the chart because it varies by your income, you know, so that's why you'll have to cross-reference a little bit to subtract that out, and then it shows what premiums would be if we set different levels of income level premiums. If we set premiums at different income levels, and this is from Mr. Godfrey's presentation that he gave from us a couple weeks ago. You know, so a couple observations I had. Was one is the regional variation in terms of affordability based on what people spend at different income levels. I don't know if there's anything we can really do with that, or both practically and politically. So I just put that out there. But
Representative Thiessen, I would just say this. In other states that have adopted affordability standards, they have done it regionally because of the difference in cost of living from one region to another. So I don't think it's out of the question that we think about that, especially, you know, since there is such a big difference between the metro area and, let's just take the northwestern part of the state, for example. Mm-hmm.
We can break it into greater regional. I mean, Jobs Now, I think, had 8 or 9 different regional categories.
Yeah, more than that.
Okay. So if we want to go down that path, that's a possibility.
And I would suggest that there's two ways you could go down that path. You could go down that path in terms of the income level at which you would give a subsidy. So you'd be eligible for Minnesota Care, let's say, at 300% in the metro area, but you'd leave it at 275 for a region of the state that has a lower cost of living. Another way to look at it is how much is the premium that you pay, or, you know, maybe people at higher income levels in one region receive some state assistance, whereas in another region they wouldn't, and or the premiums they pay would be different.
Madam Chair? Now, there's also a difference geographically on health care costs and premiums, right? I mean, one of the bandings, and I don't know how that works. Is it more expensive to insure people in the cities than it is rurally?
Yes.
Okay, so both ways we're looking at lower cost of living and lower health care premium costs in the greater Minnesota.
I don't know why it's lower in rural Minnesota. I don't know if it's because there's more primary care emphasis. I don't know if it's because, I don't know why it is, but yes, there are regional differences and it tends to be lower in the rural areas. Mr. Benner?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just on that, I think the discussions we had in the Senator Olson, Representative Loeffler group, the health plan people there were telling us that's generally true, but in the Duluth area and the Rochester area, costs are higher than they are in the Twin Cities, and they're the highest in the state.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's nice to know, so everything gets more complicated.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Well, so anyway, it might be that we would want to take those factors into consideration. I don't know, but why don't you continue?
Okay. Well, I don't know if people have had a chance to look through this chart and kind of get a sense of where things are. We also sent around the a 2002 report on Minnesota Care disenrollment, you know, which found generally that affordability wasn't the number one issue why people left the program, but for about 11% of people, that was the reason, the premiums were too expensive was the reason they left Minnesota Care, and that was more true at the higher levels of income. So the closer you got to 275% of poverty, the more the premiums made a difference in decisions as to whether to drop Minnesota Care coverage. And there may be other reasons why, you know, why there may be different reasons why that's the case, but I thought that was at least helpful information to take into account as we think about how we want to scale this thing up. Maybe we can break this down, though, by a couple of general cuts, and then we can get more to a number. I mean, I'm assuming everybody, and I think we had agreed to this before, that the sliding scale makes sense for people instead of setting one type of number?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And is there a point, I mean, do people have a sense, I mean, this is written up to 300% of poverty, the tax stuff actually goes up to 400%. Is there a sense of where we ought to have that cutoff? And I know, Senator Berglund, there's also a piece of this that ties into what we do with the tax the 125 plans and the exchange as well to kind of eliminate the cliff at whatever level we cut it off. But maybe we should have some discussion a little bit around whether 300% is the right point in time where we stop saying this is the affordability. You know, above that, people have to pay whatever they have to pay.
Well, I think one of the reasons that we put 300% down here is because when other states have looked at it, they have said, you know, at least some group of people up to 300% will need to be assisted. In some states, they've said, while we won't assist groups up to 400, we'll give them the benefit of purchasing a public product. I think, especially with the federal discussion going on right now, that it would be probably pretty much impractical to go over 300% for our public programs. And it may be that we only need to go that high for some areas of the state. I know that the metro area has always been a problem. And, you know, it's kind of ironic that we've actually, we look at northwestern Minnesota here, and we've actually, that's one of the regions of the state that we've had the greatest enrollment in Minnesota Care. And I don't know if it has to do with, you know, they have a lot more small businesses, they have a lot less employer coverage offered, or if it has to do with the affordability issue. I just don't know. I always thought it was because they had less, they had fewer large employers and they had less employer-sponsored insurance available to them. But I don't know for sure. Mr. Benner?
Yeah, Madam Chair, in response to Representative Thiessen's question, I mean, I think there's one other variable in this, and that is what, in fact, it might cost you to get insurance. I mean, if we were looking at a fully community-rated product available to everybody, so the rate's the rate, then saying the cutoff is 300%, you know, I can track that through because the number's the same. But if you are in the, if your employed group is just a whole bunch of old folks, people my age would do, you know, a bunch of old folks, and your employer contributes little or nothing to family coverage, you could have a horrendous premium confronting you. That is simply a function of where you happen to work. If you're in the individual market right now and you are older and choose not to buy a very high deductible policy, and I think we have other proposals we're looking at which are suggesting at least some things come to the other side of the deductible, but if you were to try to buy what would be a standard employer employment-based policy in the individual market and you're in your 60 to 64, I mean, you can be looking at $800, $900, $1,000 a month for that policy, and you can get over 300% of poverty real fast, and that is effectively unaffordable for you. So, I mean, there may be some realities about where we can get money near how we move money for folks, but I mean, if in the current market, people making ostensibly a lot of money can be confronted with a premium number just by the accident of the individual market or where they work, where you know, it would meet an unaffordability test for at least some part of that. I mean, at some point, you just say, yes, you're not going to take a trip to Disney World every winter, and you know, and that's your problem. It's not our collective problem. But you can get over $60,000 a year in a family with just, say, if you're in the individual market for that family or you're in the wrong employer for that family, I think you could have, to me, would not be affordable.
Well, let's just review for a minute here so we're all on the same page. In Minnesota Care, it's not considered employer coverage if the employer pays less than 50% of the premium. Now, where we get into a little bit of trouble, because back in the days when this standard was created, we didn't have all these complications of our current insurance system, where it gets a little complicated is it's done on the basis of the total package. So let's just say the employer is providing 70% of the individual workers' premium, but only providing 30% of the dependent coverage. Well, you could still have them meeting the 50% standard, but maybe the families aren't taking the dependent coverage because they really just can't afford to pay 70% of the cost of it. So that's one issue, whether, you know, we want to change that recommendation so, you know, at least the kids can get covered in those situations through our public programs. But if it's 50% coverage, then even if the group is old, an older group that the employer is covering, they still, and so it costs them more, the employer would still have to be covering at least 50% of that higher cost in order for it to be considered employer coverage for the purposes of eliminating them from being eligible for Minnesota Care. And of course, in our Medicaid program, there is no employer barrier.
Madam Chair, let me raise this, and now I just can use state of Minnesota as an employer for an example. Now, is the family premium affordable for people that work full time? Yes. But if you work part time, that starts to differ depending on how few hours you work and what your hourly rate is. You start to get into, you know, tighter numbers. We were talking the other day about Minneapolis schools. And for part-time workers in the Minneapolis schools, family coverage can be $700 or $800 a month out of that worker's pocket.
Are they still paying 50% of the coverage?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, now, because if they're part-time, maybe they're not.
Yeah, they may not be. But I think a question I raise is, and I'm one who typically errs on the side of wanting to incent, you know, using the public program as the vehicle. But if Minneapolis schools as an employer is paying something for that part-time worker, are we better off figuring out how we subsidize that person within the Minneapolis school pool, near term in any event, mm-hmm. as opposed to figuring out ways that we bring the person in here mm-hmm. and then lose the Minneapolis school employer's contribution? And, you know, I'm someone who likes public single payer, but near term, if we're trying to stretch the money, it seems to me, you know, we'll find people in the private market who do not meet an affordability test, but it'll be cheaper near term at least to find a way that we help them stay in that market as opposed to bringing them into Minnesota Care.
And I think, you know, that we really need to break the discussion into parts here because, first of all, we have people that have no insurance. Mm-hmm. No insurance offered to them through their employer, and they may or may not be eligible for a public program today. What is a fair share for them to pay toward that public coverage? Then we have the other problem of people who have employer coverage, but for whatever reason, the deductible is so high or whatever is going on makes it so they really don't have insurance either. They can't afford to pay their cost-sharing part of it, or, you know, they've got a $5,000 or $6,000 deductible, and they can't afford to pay the deductible, so they don't take the coverage. Whatever it is, that is another discussion, and we need to have that discussion. That needs to be part of what we recommend. But if we could break it into two parts, then I think we could get done with one part, and then we could get to the other part, okay? I, for one, believe that there are a number of people. In fact, I saw numbers yesterday that, you know, between 3,000 and 4,000 people that potentially would be eligible for Minnesota Care if we don't verify employer information at the time of enrollment, if we just spot check it rather than having that employer sign the slip before they can enroll. So to me that says, well, you know, there's people out there that have employer coverage that need help. And they wouldn't be coming to the state enrolling and going through all the hassle of paying a premium if they didn't feel they needed it and if they didn't feel that if they felt they could get something affordable through their employer, they wouldn't be coming. So I think we do need to discuss it.
Okay.
So back to this chart. Let's just pretend this chart is just about people who don't have insurance and who would be looking at needing public coverage. And what do we think is the right amount, the fair amount that they should pay toward their own coverage when they're at 200 or 300% of poverty? Yes.
And are we still talking about premiums and out-of-pockets? Although in Minnesota Care, there are not a lot of out-of-pockets unless you get hospitalized and then you potentially have a lot of out-of-pocket, right? I mean, that's where the where the rub is. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But we are talking about both. Right.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Although the numbers here are just the premium costs.
Yes.
On the, right? Is that what that says?
It's just the premium costs.
Okay.
Well, it's I mean, it you could say it's the premium cost. You could also say, I mean, this is just, I mean, that's 8% of that income level. You know, so whether.
Right, whatever
it
the.
It could be the premium and out of pockets, too.
Okay.
Holly, is it?
Yes, well, Dr. Roden.
I mean, I was just playing around a little bit on if you look at, what was this, like if you're looking at people in the 200% of poverty at 7% health care costs, I'm not quite sure exactly what I was all comparing, but, you know, I mean, part of the thing that's a little hard to, or at least for me to figure out, was comparing the yearly costs subtracted from the yearly costs on the left-hand side and then breaking that back into monthly costs. But like one of these, I think it was for Northwest Minnesota, even at 7% of their income in healthcare costs, they're really, you're left with like $500 a month left over, which isn't a whole lot of money to do much of anything with, let alone savings, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So I just think that it's that's sort of the next piece of it in terms of what, when we're thinking about what the affordability piece of it is what we're then leaving people. Do you know what I'm saying?
Can you repeat
that? Yeah, I think, I hope I did the math right here. But so it's 7% of spending for the two, oh, hold on. No, you already did it for me. Never mind.
$189.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I missed that line.
Yeah, so you're. And just so people understand again what this chart is showing on the right side of the page, you know, like, for instance, if you go to the 200% of poverty line, that's not actually 7% of their income. It's actually 5.4% of their income because each of these are scaled up.
Right. We're talking
the
about
same scale as the same percentage increases as we have in Minnesota Care. So, for instance,
we're talking about the exit level of the premium. So whatever we set it at, if we set it at 5, then we'd have to scale back everything underneath that so that it would be proportional.
So if you look
at... If we set it at 8, then we'd be have to scale it back a little bit.
So at 7% of income, if you just look at that column, for instance, at 300% of poverty, that 361 a month is 7% of income.
Okay.
At 200% of poverty, they're actually only paying 5.4% of their income because, you know, as in Minnesota Care, we have a sliding scale, so the percentage increases as you go up.
Okay.
And I guess when I'm looking at this, one of the concerns I have is when I saw it originally, I didn't understand that this was before taxes. So then when you look at this little tax chart over here, it seems like people had a lot of money, but when you look at this little tax chart, then it doesn't seem like they have so much money. And, you know, if you're looking at a single adult who's going to pay over $6,000 a year in taxes at the 300% poverty level, and then you look at a single adult in the metro area, and what they have left over for the year is a little over $12,000, well, half of that's gone for taxes already, so really what they have left over is $6,000. And if what they have left over is $6,000, and they're going to be paying, you know, if they're going to be paying close to $3,000 a year for their premium, I think that's going to make it hard.
for people.
Mr. Benner.
Madam Chair, yeah. I would add two items or try to seek two other types of items to kind of put in the matrix here. Revenue gave us data on federal payroll, then federal and state income. I mean, I know they have data that the income work on to deal with sales tax and local government property tax as what people will in fact wind up paying at different income levels, just to kind of have in the mix here.
Those, and just to the sales taxes are likely, I think, under the Jobs Now stuff included, right? And at least some are included in some of these right now.
Okay.
And that's going to vary by income. And the house and the property taxes are probably in the housing.
And then the other part I would think we would want to include somewhere in here is some assessment on what people ought to be putting away for retirement. They may or may not be doing it. But, you know, as people talk about the three- or four-legged stool to make it once you turn 65, one of the things is we're asking people to be putting X percent of their, you know, salary aside here. And I don't know enough about this as to what the number ought to be. But there are, you know, you can find out what folks say ought to be being put away. But that's probably going to be another 4, 5, 6, 7 percent of gross income. And
that's a good point.
Other comments?
This is helpful. I mean, this helps you get at it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess the only other comment I would make, just so everybody understands, is these are, like we said, these are scaled up at the kind of proportionately to what Minnesota Care is doing. So, you know, arguably that Minnesota Care progression could be compressed as well. You know, so as you get
towards
the higher rate.
I think it's best to look at the 300% of poverty level for the comparison, because we're not, I mean, at 200%, we're down, you know, I'm sure we're at 5% or less, so.
Easy. Yeah.
So the chart doesn't really work for that. So I would look at the 300%. And, you know, what I get out of it is that I think there definitely should be some scaling based on region. Because I look at this single person in northwestern Minnesota, and, you know, they're going to have, if they were at the 9.6% level, and they're paying $6,000 in taxes. They're going to have
$9,500.
Yeah, they're going to have over $9,000 left, and then if they're paying $3,000 a year in taxes, I mean, in premiums, they're going to have $6,000 left, whereas this other person's only got $3,000 left in the metro area, and that's quite a difference. And so I think that's one of the things I come away from this with.
Would it be worthwhile to go around the table and get a sense of where everybody's at in terms of what they think is a reasonable percentage? Just so we can kind of move forward here. I don't care what side you
start. Yeah, let's start on this side. What do you think, Lisa?
Well, one of the other things that occurs to me is the credit card debt that I don't know how we might factor into this, but just thinking in terms of the extra income families would have. So I'm thinking like 6% in that area.
Are you thinking that we should be looking at geography a little bit in terms of
Absolutely, yeah. Because mm-hmm. okay. people are just so on that edge. You know, it takes nothing to tip them over, so.
Okay. Let's just keep going down the road.
I agree with the geography. And when I look at the tax effect, I could even be at 5%.
I concur with that.
5%?
5%.
Okay.
Do you want me to go?
Yes. Oh, if you want to.
No. Yeah. I mean, I would probably be, I'd probably go towards 7 or 8%.
I think around 6%, but it would definitely have to be, I mean, just coming from the Iron Range, and I think it definitely would have to be by geography.
I agree with the geography, and I think 6% would be reasonable.
I agree with the geography, and I would be at 5.
Definitely the geographic factor combined, and I think I would pick 6 to 7.
6 to 7.
I think I'd say the same. I think it has to be adjusted, and I'll be wishy-washy and say 6. But the other question I would ask is, isn't there, other than just a straight percentage, a fairer way to index in some way through a credit so that everybody actually, in the end, gets the same amount of benefit?
Well, we haven't figured one out. You know, when you look at what 125 does, it's definitely skewed to the higher income people. You know, there's been some discussion, oh, well, it makes some people's incomes have been reduced enough so they're now actually eligible for the working family credit. I mean, you know, another subsidy. You know, I don't get real excited about somehow I've made somebody better off because I've reduced their income because they've now got a tax-free benefit so that they're eligible for a different public subsidy, but it definitely helps the higher income people, and there's no other way you can do it because the tax system is skewed toward the more you make, the more you pay, the more you pay, the more benefit you can get from taking something away from what you pay.
Yeah, I think if there were a mechanism to, I realize it's difficult, but if there were a mechanism that targeted this a little better, I'd be higher with I'd be happy with a higher percentage. Because I would feel comfortable that we would eliminate some of that disparity that you're talking
mm-hmm.
about.
In this case, we're just
mechanism. I would like to go to cover as many people as possible.
In this case, we're talking about not only an exit level for the percentage, but we're scaling the percentage. So we're not talking about 6% across the board. We're talking the lower your income, the lower your percentage. And then, you know, at 300% and higher, then we'd be talking about 6% if that's your number. So, you know, in some sense, you know, it becomes more than fair for the below 300%. And 300% or higher if you're going to set a 6% threshold. I would think there was some point at which people could afford more than 6% of their income.
Th- 300% Metro, I was comfortable low in the 6% range. 300% the other two geographies, I could be very comfortable closer to 8.
Do you want me to report the results, or is it pretty clear? So.
Well, I think that
it gives us a sense of where
it gives us a sense of where we're at, and I guess maybe we could just go back. And for people who said that they thought 5 or 6 was good, but they thought we should be taking geography into account, were you talking about the 5 or 6 at the metro level or at the other regional levels?
I was talking about metro. for
Metro?
6%. Yeah.
So higher for the others? Mm-hmm. Is that true for everyone else too? Okay.
No.
No?
I don't think so.
Okay. So let's go back around and get that part down, because I think that confused me. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, actually, what percent I am a little, for Metro you, and what percent for...
Well, whether the... Yeah, I guess maybe if you're at... You were saying 6%. Are you talking about 6% at the Metro level and a higher percent for the other regions, or are you talking about 6% for the other regions and a lower percent for the Metro area?
I'm thinking that that would be the max that anyone would... I'm trying to maximize... let's see. The person that has the most left over in a month, is that, would that be then, let's see, the Metro...
No, it'd be the Northwest.
North, yeah. So I was thinking the 6%. They would have the most income to deal with.
So outside 6%.
So then lower for the others.
Right, right.
Okay.
I was thinking of 5% for the Metro, so higher for the others.
Okay.
I think I was thinking 5% at the highest. So that would be, I guess, 5% for Greater Minnesota and lower for the Metro.
Okay.
And I was 6% for Metro, and I could be higher for Northwestern Minnesota.
Same.
I will support Sister Roden.
I was 6-7 and the higher percent to Greater Min.
I was thinking of sticking at 5% moving to embarrass Minnesota. It sounded pretty good. but my wishy-washy 6 was that actually I'd be comfortable 5 in the Metro and higher in the outstate.
And I was already there. 6 and higher.
Okay.
6 and... 6 and what?
Okay.
It says 7 or 8.
All right, now have we made your job easy enough to tabulate this?
Well, what I have basically is the vast majority of people are at 6 or 5% in the room, a few more at 6 than at 5. And that what I heard people saying was that I heard three people say that what they said as their number was the cap, and I heard six people say that it was the floor, in a sense, if that's a way of talking about it. So... kind of a little bit of division on that issue. Not necessarily consensus on that issue. But I imagine that cap and floor issue varies depending on where you land on the percentage, too. So, and let's see. I guess the other point, then, is the people that were capping it were also at the lower end of the, generally at the lower end of percentages. So the people that said... the percentage they said would apply to Northwest Minnesota were also the people more likely to say 5%. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
So does that give us enough to make a recommendation?
Sure. Okay. Well, do people think it gives us enough to make a recommendation? Is there
on this piece, we still have the discussion about the employed mm-hmm. person piece.
Right.
Okay. So this is. This whole discussion was just around Minnesota Care public programs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. As they now exist.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
for people who are
actually thinking of going to 300%.
Right.
That's what
right.
We're
but I mean, in term. Correct. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Can I just raise one more issue with regard to Minnesota Care and public programs on this issue, and that is this 50% rule and whether 50% is the right percentage today. That you don't qualify, you know, if your employer covers 50%, when it was passed, 50% was probably a different number than it is now because we push more costs onto employees. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's a discussion to be had around. I think it fits in with the affordability discussion a little mm-hmm. if we're dividing up the question. Does everybody understand? Yeah.
That was obviously probably a low number in 92 or 93, you know.
Well, it wasn't arrived at very scientifically. Somebody in the room said, well, if we're going to say you have to have employer-based coverage, what do we mean? you know, you can't have employer-based coverage to be eligible. What do we mean by that? Mm-hmm. And somebody else said, well, how would you even be able to consider it being employer coverage if they aren't offering at least 50% coverage? And that was the end of the discussion. I wish everything was that easy these days. So, you know, and it seemed reasonable because, you know, there would, I mean, that is the federal tax standard for if you're going to take it as a deduction. So, but in my own mind.
Has that number changed, Senator Berglund? Mm-hmm. I mean, at that point, has that number changed? No. Federal, it hasn't. Okay.
But it has occurred to me recently that having it be sort of an average for all the family members might not be fair. And that, you know, we might want to at least look at imposing the standard on dependent coverage as well as employer coverage. Pete.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I mean, it's the absolute dollar cost of premiums has more than tripled from 92-93 to where they are today. So 50% of, family coverage for a state, family coverage for a state employee in the early 90s cost totally under $500 a month, and it is now $1,500 a month. So half of 500 would be 250, and you were essentially saying that as long as an employer put in $250, you know, that was kind of enough. Right now, if the employer continued to put in, the employer would have to put in $750 to meet the same standard, but the worker would be exposed to $750 on their end, and in that same time frame, average wages have gone up like 50%. So I think what's happened on the standard is the absolute dollar exposure of an individual is far worse today than it was in the early 90s.
I agree.
And to me, this is kind of less almost as a percent than is how many, you know, what's the absolute dollar value you're being asked to put out.
Mm-hmm.
Let me suggest one thing on this as it's going on. Maybe we ought to have the discussion about the employed people first and then come back to this.
Mm-hmm.
Figure out where we land on affordability and that may resolve this whole question too.
Yeah, so. I agree because I think that there's a group of people, even if you set it at, let's just say, 75%, they're still not going to be able to afford the 25%. You know, if you're making minimum wage, you're probably not going to be able to afford 25% of $1,500. So my thinking was that there should be some sort of affordability test for people who have private coverage, and if you don't meet that test, then we create a way to subsidize your coverage through your employer. I mean, I'm not just thinking everybody automatically should come into MinnesotaCare. I'm thinking, you know, there ought to be some way to preserve what we can get from the employer coverage, but provide a subsidy also to that individual to be able to afford the employer coverage. And today we do have ability to buy employer coverage, but it has to meet a cost-benefit test, and very few of the private employer policies meet the cost-benefit test because the cost-benefit test is against what a Medicaid benefit would have been. And by and large, the Medicaid benefit is much better than the employer benefit. So I think there really needs to be some more work done and some more looking at how you would do this. Now, one of the problems with doing this, I might add, because I am in favor of trying to do something, but one of the problems with doing it is that it has resulted in states that have tried to do it in quite high administrative costs. So, you know, you don't want to end up having something cost so much to administer that, you know, you can't afford to do the darn thing anyway. So that's another concern about it. But
okay.
other ideas, other thoughts?
You're welcome.
All right.
What are we talking about right now?
Sorry. We are talking about affordability for people who have employer-based coverage. And we're talking about whether we think there should be some way to help people purchase their employer-based coverage. I'll make this real clear. And then if people want to have it be something else, we can just say so. But a way to help people purchase that employer-based coverage so that it would be affordable for them to have it. Let's just think if we were going to say everybody was going to have coverage. What would you need to do to make sure that it was possible in terms of people at... And remember that usually the way employer coverage works is everybody pays the same, regardless of your income. You know, you can be the minimum wage file clerk. You still contribute just as much toward your health insurance as, you know, the vice president does. So I don't see in the near future trying to get health care benefits provided by employers on an affordability basis. So then I guess there has to be something to fill that gap. Yes.
Well, just a couple of thoughts, which probably will just muck it up, I imagine. But I think the issue of, one, having affordability standard for people in the current employer market is an excellent idea. But I do think that, particularly if we're looking at a mechanism where the state then subsidizes that person to purchase that particular plan, is you do, just in terms of the state sustainability, I think you can't get away from having some kind of criteria of what that plan is. Because, I mean, over the last couple of months, I've been looking through a number of the different plans that we've negotiated for our members with employers. And depending upon the employer, there's some really bad plans out there. I mean, I was frankly kind of shocked, particularly nursing home plans, but actually even not just nursing home plans. So the idea that the state sort of continues to subsidize a whole bunch of potentially underinsured people, I think is a problem for the state, let alone for the people. So, I mean, I know it begins to muck up the thing about, well, you know, how do you administer, you know, do you have somebody in the state that's looking at every, you know, employer plan and how it matches some, you know, minimum benefit set or something. But I do think that it's a slippery slope that we go down without realizing that we're going to have to address that, because, I mean, even those plans aren't cheap. The not very good plans are still pretty expensive out there. And if all the mechanism is just to make sure that people, you know what I'm trying to say? I just think that it's...
So maybe you could help me a little bit, because I'm not exactly sure I know what you mean, what you're saying. When you say not very good plan, are you talking about not very good in terms of high deductibles? Are you talking about not very good in terms of what the benefits are that are covered?
Yep. High deductibles, limited benefit, just limited benefit plans at all. Those are the biggest patterns that I've seen. The people are at a large liability out of pocket up front on the high deductible plans, where they basically, what they're buying is a limited benefit plan, so that if they actually do get sick, they're liable for all the costs at the far end. So it's either that you pay it first end or you pay it later, but you end up, people are at very high personal liability for cost.
Well, I think if you're talking about deductibles, that would be included in what we're talking about in terms of affordability. We're not just talking about premiums here. We're talking about out-of-pocket. So deductibles would be included. It's actually administratively a lot easier to buy off a deductible for somebody than it is to do premium sharing.
Oh, I think that makes a lot of sense, actually. If that's what we're thinking, but... So if the idea was that the employer has a high deductible plan, you certified that, or however this person is at, you know, whatever the affordability standard is, that the state then picks up basically all that upfront out of pocket, potentially.
Well, some of it anyway, depending on.
I mean, I think that has, I mean, what I think that will encourage plan employers to do, potentially, is all move to high deductible plans, which may or may not be a bad thing. But again, I think it begins to put, I mean,
well,
I just.
If you're basing what you do for somebody on income, then if you're going to do that for everybody, you're going to still have some people that are paying it themselves.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess my concern is that the mechanism of simply subsidizing to keep the sort of employers in the game, I just think that it gets more complicated, I guess.
Oh, it is. It's very complicated.
I mean, in some way.
That's why it's difficult to administer and why it's hard to figure out what to do and all of that. And that's why we need to talk about it.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair. Do we have any information on some of the other states that have done some of the premium subsidy work with Medicaid expansion that shows how they've dealt with that problem where they have kept people in their private coverage? I mean, is there any information on that? I thought.
Well, we did review what Vermont and Massachusetts, Massachusetts didn't do anything. We reviewed what Vermont did. In addition to that, Washington State recently set up kind of a voluntary connector. And they put a fixed amount of dollars in to subsidize employees who would be coming into the connector through a small employer who were at 200% of poverty or less. So they would subsidize the product that would be purchased then through the connector. I think other than those examples, they're really the only other one there is this purchasing based on cost effectiveness. And I think about half the states maybe in the union have that. But there's very few policies being purchased through that mechanism. The state of Minnesota has that in our current public programs, but very few policies are actually purchased. Instead, what happens is people come into the public program because the cost effectiveness standard is not met in the private product. What Massachusetts did was they just said, if you have private insurance and, you know, it meets the 8% threshold for you, then you have to buy it or pay a fine. If you don't, you're exempted. That's all they did. Any other ideas?
One other thought on this issue, I mean, it goes back to our earlier discussion, but, you know, to keep the private market there, creating some kind of penalty, you know, for people that are dropping coverage, I guess, I'm talking to someone behind me, so maybe that came up already. I'm sorry if it did. But, the problem there being, in some sense, you're punishing people that were doing the right thing before, and I'm not sure, you know, people that never offered insurance coverage, they won't suffer a penalty because they never offered it, so they won't be dropping it in a sense. And so we'd have to.
Well, or you could do it for both.
Or right.
I mean, if you drop coverage, then you'd be in the same category as people who never offered, and you'd have some sort of a assessment that they would pay. I doubt under ERISA you can make it be very bold or very meaningful or very much of a disincentive to drop coverage. But what they keep telling us in Massachusetts, and we'll see, you know, if they're right, is that there's just a lot of, once you're required to have coverage, there's a lot of employee pressure on employers to provide or maintain coverage because, you know, they don't want to have to be entirely responsible for it all on their own.
I think also to that, though, is that at least initially, after they passed the mandate, there was at least some, you know, buzz around the idea that employees that had not opted for their employer coverage that were now opting for it pushed at least some of the smaller, particularly nonprofit organizations, to a point where they simply couldn't afford to provide coverage for everybody. I mean, the only reason they were able to do it at all was that basically not everybody picked it up. And now that everybody was picking it up, they were kind of like, we got no budget for this. So there's those kind of unintended consequences. But the other sort of going back to Representative Thiessen's comment in an earlier discussion, I don't know how this would work exactly, but I mean, a way of sort of equalizing, I mean, I understand that we need to keep employers in play because they're providing a huge chunk of money to fund the whole system. And I totally understand that. The problem with the employer-based system is that it's not very reliable. You know, you move in and out of employment all the time. The whole idea of trying to do a medical home when you're moving in and out of employment and you're changing health plans and you're potentially changing providers is kind of, I don't understand how it works very well. So that whole piece of it, but so what I'm wondering is if there might not be an alternative way of getting that, keeping the employer's money in the game, so to speak. And I know that you can't, because of ERISA challenges, but couldn't you do sort of a broad-based, you know, health tax that wasn't necessarily...
No. You could do a broad-based tax, but not a health tax. If you want to meet the ERISA test.
So you're not necessarily, it's not connected to whether they provide a plan, what the plan is, or anything else. It's just across the board, everybody has to kick in this much money.
Well, then you're talking about, an income tax or corporate tax. You're not talking about a health tax. You might be using it for a health reason, but you're not talking about health tax.
Okay. All right, then maybe the point I want to do, going back to Representative Thiessen's point, is that if not, in 08, at some point, again, to both, I mean, part of the reason that Massachusetts had enough money to actually fund what they did was that they had $600 million sitting there in what was their uncompensated care thing, pool, to pay for it. So they had a ton of money.
Right, and I would just remind people who want to use that we don't have a $600 million uncompensated care pool. But we do have almost a $500 million provider tax pool that they didn't have. So they had no Minnesota Care-like program, and they created one. We have one to build on that we're already paying for. And so... partly paying for some of the people who would be eligible, at least.
I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's, looking long-term, trying to figure out how you keep the employer's money in the system by bolstering up the employer-based stuff, I think is not a good long-term strategy. I'll just say that.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of sensing that we don't really have a solution to this problem, but we believe that we need to continue to work toward a solution so that people can be insured when they have employer coverage offered to them, but that it can be done in a way that's affordable for them, and then expecting them to have it is a more reasonable thing to do. Is that a fair...
I guess the...
And maybe there's ways you could start doing it without, I could see how it could be done for deductibles. People that have deductible problems. You could set up a system where you would subsidize deductibles. Subsidizing premiums is a harder thing, and so maybe that leads us to Representative Thiessen's discussion of what should constitute the definition of affordable, what should comprise the definition of employer coverage for public program purposes. And then we're talking about people at or below whatever percent, 275, 300, whatever. And we're just talking about people then in the lower income categories and how much their employer should have to be contributing in order for us to consider them ineligible to come in a public door. Mr. Benner.
Yeah, Madam Chair. To me, working through the issue for the already covered, you know, and that's maybe it's 91% as of now as opposed to 93%. But if we fail to put together at least a fairly detailed roadmap of where we want to try to take that, we won't miss a great opportunity. But in terms of the folks who are going to be weighing in with their senators and representatives on this, to be coming up with a set of proposals which doesn't address their biggest concern, which is it's not affordable to me now, or I don't think it's going to be affordable for me next year. We, in fact, wind up losing support for how we're dealing with the 9%. Just being in this discussion, I mean, the difficulty of, the competing objectives of keeping employer money now out there in the system without setting up in a system that is so impossible that, that we can't administer it. I understand, the conundrum there. I mean, for a while I have been thinking in my head that as you're thinking about how you would be making a, an insurance exchange and whatever products are approved for sale through the exchange, perhaps that can be a vehicle for how you move money into the employed market. So instead of trying to figure out how we do this with thousands of plans, we're dealing with this with a finite number of plans, although that then creates an issue for employers. Am I insuring 95% of my folks or 90% of my folks through my standard Medica product, my standard Health Partners product? But if I want to help people be affordable for that other group, I got to go through the connector, which has its own set of issues.
It would be easier to subsidize a premium if you were doing it through a connector. Then we're just talking about employers of 50 or less.
Yeah. But as I said,
But that would be another piece of what you could do.
For example, the state of Minnesota has employees who work less than 50% time. University has people, their cutoff is 75% time, and I expect for most large employers the cutoff for any subsidies a lot closer to the universities than it is for the states, that you got real large employers who don't cover, who don't provide anything for thousands and thousands and thousands of folks, and maybe they're getting coverage through the spouse someplace else. I know just from the AFSCME standpoint for state service, the proposal that comes in most frequently every year for bargaining is to allow people that are under the cutoff to be into the group, because it's seen at a minimum as a better deal than what they are now or the only way they get any coverage whatsoever. So even for, so you can get the big employers. And if we actually are saying we're trying to address lack of insurance or unaffordable for their folks, I mean, we start right here and kind of work down to the U, and I expect really big folks which have that issue. So to me, a small group solution really doesn't get you to where you need to get to.
I know it doesn't. I mentioned it, however, because at least there is one thing you could do there.
Yes, yeah.
I think if you're talking about public employers, you're talking about, providing them some money and requiring them to do something. But we have a lot of other employers, retail.
Right.
And things where, you don't get covered unless you're 100%, and 90% of the workforce is under 100%. But if you don't get covered at all, and you're under 300% of poverty in this discussion, you would be eligible to come in a public door. It's people who have coverage, but, you know, as you said earlier, they're paying, you know, $750 or $800 a month for that coverage, and they are only making, you know, $1,000 a month or something, and so they just don't buy it because they can't afford it. It's those people that we need to figure out what we would do about. Yes?
Just a clarifying question. Why is it that the connector is only for employers under 50? Does it have to be that way, or is that just how it's been designed in places where it's been designed?
Well, that's how it's been designed in places where it's been designed, because the major purpose of the connector is to give people a 125 benefit, a 125 tax benefit. And the feeling is that most larger employers or even medium-sized employers already provide a 125 benefit for their employees, and they don't need a connector to do it. So some smaller employers don't, maybe aren't signed up for 125. Individuals can't get it at all unless they go through a mechanism. And so that's the idea. Now, if you, and part of the conundrum also about the connector is you have to have the same rules for insurance coverage and pricing inside the connector as you do outside the connector. Mm. If you allow products to be offered to the same group outside of a connector, because otherwise you're skewing things for risk selection. And we only have the authority as a state to set the rules of the game for fully insured books of business. And, I mean, there are some fully insured that are more than 50, but they're getting fewer and fewer. So that's part of it also.
Now I think if I understand Massachusetts, that they set it up so that if your employer offered and you were eligible for insurance, that's basically where you were, where you had to go for your insurance to meet the mandate. If you couldn't afford it, or for whatever reason you went out on the, you know, you individually went through the connector and would have qualified for a subsidy, you wouldn't get the subsidy. So you were kind of...
No, you could, if you decided you just wanted to buy individual policy, even though your employer offered you coverage, you could go purchase it through the connector.
I will check on that, but I actually think that they didn't set it up that way. But I'll double check, because I could be mistaken about that. But I think that if you were eligible and offered insurance through your employer, the expectation is that is where you would get it. But let's say if we don't set it up that way, there'd be no particular reason why, if I worked for a big employer, couldn't afford their coverage, wanted to come through the connector as an individual, I'd be able to do that, in theory, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of, well, I'm looking at the clock and thinking of maybe wanting to make some recommendations next week. My sense is that we're not going to make all of our recommendations next week, and we'll have to get together again. But it seems like we have a sense on the public programs where we could make some kind of a recommendation. We'll provide a list of perhaps ideas. But on the employed side, are we also going to have an affordability standard, and is that going to be different than the standard we set up that we discussed before, or is the thing that we discussed before apply in both places, if that makes sense? And I'm just not clear about that.
Are you asking if they're going to be the same for public and private insured?
Is what we talked about before, are we talking about all Minnesotans, or are we just talking about people in
public programs,
in Minnesota Care, essentially?
Okay.
And I'm not clear on what we're. I want to go back and clarify that.
Mr. Penner?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen. I don't think we've resolved that. There's a way to get at least in part, the employed base, the employer issue, by redefining the test for the employer exclusion. But I'm saying only in part. I suppose you could define that in such a way that
it would be impossible to pay more than some percentage.
And then if you are, or either percent, and if you're in that situation, you're automatically eligible for the public program. That solves the problem, or at least in part solves the problem from the individual standpoint, but then you're losing a whole bunch of employer contribution money. But, I mean, I can see how you can get there. I mean, this would essentially be using Minnesota Care or a variation of that as the vehicle for individual affordability. It has a whole bunch of pluses to it. The negative, unfortunately, is you're losing employer money. By the way, I think the same sort of issue applies to the individual market. You know, if we're going to say that the standard for the Minnesota Care at 300% of poverty is whatever, even if we were looking at the high end of this, this automatically means a whole bunch of people in the individual market do not have affordable products. And then is our answer there to subsidize them in the individual market, or is our answer there to bring them into Minnesota Care as individuals, regardless of their, and part of the issue, and I know this from a provider standpoint, is it is one thing to have expansion of the Minnesota Care product, give it its current limitations on coverage and its current reimbursement systems. It's one thing to have that being something that we are hoping to have as the vehicle for, X percent of the population. Mm-hmm. It's a whole another animal if that is to be the vehicle for a much bigger amount of the population. And, the HCMC person on the Olson Loeffler group thought I was saying Minnesota Care ought to be the vehicle for, 25% of Minnesotans. I don't think I was saying that. But, as a provider, that person got real concerned, and I understand why. It was, the pieces all come back and connect to each other here. I think we have to address the issue. We're clearly not ready to address it today, but I don't think we ought to be going into session without some recommendations, acknowledging this one may be horribly messy just given the competing forces here, but perhaps even explaining that the messiness is inherent in trying to, I think, Holly's point earlier, is inherent in trying to solve, in one state unaffordability in the employer market or the individual market without having all the tools to do it. But we have to raise, I think clearly we have to raise the issue, and we have to do the best we can of finding a way to help people who can't get affordable coverage now outside the Minnesota Care market.
And I will say that last year on the Senate side, we did have a proposal that if premiums and or deductibles exceeded 8% of your income and you qualified income-wise, that you could come into Minnesota Care. That proposal was not accepted by the administration. But we at least were trying to think about... We were still trying to think about what to do about it. Of course, it was being proposed without a mandate. It was being proposed on a voluntary basis. So I just throw that out there for whatever it's worth also.
I think just to Representative Thiessen's question, I think it would be important if there's going to be an affordability standard set for the public programs at whatever income level it's set at, that needs to apply to everybody in the state. I don't know the mechanisms to make that happen, but I just think that politically, to Pete's point earlier, that if we're looking at a 9% solution sort of without addressing the needs of the 91%, it's going to be way harder to actually accomplish it than if we're looking at a solution that actually speaks to at least one very serious need of the other 91%.
I agree with that, but I must just express a concern that I have about that. I don't know where we're at today on average contributions that individuals make to their employer coverage, but I sincerely expect that it's more than 5 or 6%. And if we're going to have a recommendation where we subsidize virtually you know, 90% of the population in the state, then I have a concern about the sustainability of that recommendation.
I agree with that, although I also think just as, I mean, I don't know if it would be, you know, 95% of the population, but I also think that the reality out there is that we've got, you know, I don't know, I mean, I'm pulling numbers out of the air, 45-50%. I mean, there's a very large part of the population that really has unaffordable insurance, and for us just to say it's not, for us not to call it, for us not to say that it's there doesn't mean it's not there. And I understand that we can't all do it in 08. I understand all of that, but I still think it's you know, the reality is that is the reality, and it's only going to get worse if we're not able to do cost containment stuff in a big way and do all the other things everybody else is talking about. And we should call it what it is. I think I mean, it's easy for me to say, right? But
I understand what you're saying, and what I'm trying to say back to you is, okay, let's just say it's 50% of the population that has unaffordable insurance today for the purpose of this discussion. Then we should at least set the benchmark so we're only capturing 50%, not 95%, which I think if you're at a 5% or 6% contribution threshold, you're going to catch way more than the 50%.
Well, but now, we were only talking about the 5 or 6% at 300% of poverty.
No, we're also, right? I mean, if we apply it generally to the population, then we're talking about 300% and above.
Well, no, I was actually.
This is part of the question I wanted to get to. Are we extending 6% across the board, or does it continue to go up, that percentage?
Well, okay. Maybe I didn't answer the earlier question right. I mean, I guess I was thinking that it's 3% and below, whether you're on Minnesota Care or not. Whatever that standard should be the same. Because I think there are people who are at 300% poverty that are on private insurance.
Sure, there.
Right, yeah. But if we're going to say for Minnesota Care you're only going to pay 5%, then those people should really only pay 5%. For the 300% to 600%, I'm not sure 5% is the right number. So that maybe scales up some, but I don't think that it just drops off at anybody over 300% of poverty. You're on your own. Good luck. Everything's affordable. Because I think that most of the research has shown that that's just not true. But you'd at least be lowering you'd be raising the level, lowering the potential subsidy, I guess is what I'm saying. But
do we have information, and you guys may know it most of all, about the question that I think Senator Berglund raised, which is how much are people, by decile or something, how much do people pay, how much do people pay for insurance?
Yes.
On average, how much is the employee contribution? Right. As opposed to the employer contribution for the health care that we're purchasing today.
Or what the cost of it is overall, too. You know, because that, on the individual side, that's
it varies based on your health condition, your age, your sex. I mean, my goodness, almost everything you could.
Yeah. The 2007 hard. Kaiser data from their employer survey, this was national, but I would believe this was the apply here in Minnesota or close to it. The average employee share of single coverage was in the mid 55 plus or minus. I'm trying to, this is a little, but you know, closer to 60 now than it is to 50. And the average employee share of family coverage was 275 a month plus or minus. And I had it, you know, I have a packet I normally carry around with me, and it isn't in my suitcase today. But you know, we can get to that. I mean, it's on the Kaiser website, so staff just can go to that and pull that down real fast. But so that's the average, and I think the most recent Minnesota data, and Julie's gone, I think was from 04 or 05. So there's, you'd have to wait that back for. Did he find it?
Okay. Well, we have 2005 data for Minnesota. The average employee contribution for a single person is 21%, which is of the income, which is $800. This was supposed to be for the year, right? 21% of the cost of insurance, which equals about $800 for the year.
But we don't know what that would be as a percentage of income. we'd have to do some work. Somebody'd have to do some work to figure out at 300 and above what percentage of income that is.
Yeah. No, I don't know if that's.
Madam Chair, we did look at this, and I don't have the figures in front of me, and I know it was greatly in excess of 5 or 6 or 7%, but it depended on what benefit package you modeled it on. If you model it on Minnesota Care with the limitations on hospital coverage, obviously those percents go down. If you're modeling after the federal employees package, it's more expensive, so thus more percent of your income. But we have a little of that information we can provide.
Well, I guess we'd be looking at average or private employer insurance, which would be somewhere in between those two.
I mean, just for everybody's, the family is 25% or about $2,700, the average family premium per year. That's the employee share is about $2,700, according to the Kaiser number here. This is 2005. I don't know. That's what it said. So.
Yeah.
Well, so it sounds like that there are sources of this information. We could look at the Kaiser stuff, and we can look at maybe you could get that information to us.
Sure.
Then we could make some judgments about that.
You know, we're kind of running out of time here, so maybe we can gather up some information on this issue of employer affordability, of employer coverage, and come back to it next time. And I'd also just like to mention that I think at some point soon we need to have some recommendations about how to get people continuous coverage, because I think that's a piece of making sure everybody has health care coverage all the time. And we put it on this agenda in terms of, you know, trying to create more automated eligibility for public programs, but I think we need to think about it in terms of ways to make sure if people are dropping off of employer coverage that they automatically get into the loop. And so if you want to be thinking about that for next time, I think we need to have some discussion about that. Yes, I think what we will be doing is we have to make a report to the Healthcare Access Commission next Wednesday. So we would be emailing out to you the report that we would be giving to them, and hopefully in time so you can make comments back if we've wildly gone off the track of what we've been talking about here today. Okay?
So, and then just to clarify, I would imagine those recommendations are going to be the list of mechanisms we talked about today, and probably what we talked about with regard to the under 300% of poverty government program recommendation. And then next week we'll come back and start digging in with where we're leaving off today.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. With that, the meeting's adjourned.